Welcome to Torah Mecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Tzivi Zuckerman, and today we will be studying Malachim Bet, Perek Chaf Dalid, Chapter 24. The last two chapters of Malachim are the story of the last few kings of Yehuda, Yoshiyahu's sons and grandson, who served as puppet kings over the course of the last tumultuous 20 years of Malchut Yehuda. In examining the reigns of these last few kings, we'll measure their degree of success and failure against the three themes that we've been following throughout the Sefer. These are, one, the role of the king, whose job it is to lead the people to God; two, the challenge of the king, which is the king's inner conflict of gaiva, kochi ve'utzim yadi, and self-aggrandizement, versus humility and an awareness of dependence on God; and three, the outcome of the king's choices within the divine system of human accountability, schar v'onesh. In this chapter, we'll examine the behavior and events surrounding Yehoyakim, Yoshiyahu's oldest son, and begin discussing Tzidkiyahu, Yoshiyahu's youngest son, and the last king of Yehuda. In the last parak, we explained that Yehoyakim is appointed king of Yehuda by Paro Necho, and he is confident that the Egyptians will win the wars of Carchemish. However, the Chaldeans win these wars. They rebuild the ancient city of Babylon, and they're known from here on as the Babylonians. Yirmiyahu HaNavi prophesies during this time, saying that because Yehoyakim allied himself with the Egyptians, now Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylonia, is going to come in and take over the land of Israel. The gears are already in place and turning for the process of exile and destruction that will continue to develop and unfold. Our chapter begins with this notorious Babylonian monarch, Nebuchadnezzar, a leader well known to history as a megalomaniac. In the huge building projects that he directed that have been unearthed by archaeologists, thousands of the excavated bricks bear Nebuchadnezzar's name and titles. It's ironic, perhaps, that the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, a tragedy which is so closely tied to the trait of gaiva, arrogance, took place through someone so obsessed with his own power and prestige. Radak explains that Nebuchadnezzar captures Jehoiakim and imprisons him in Bavel in the fourth year of Jehoiakim's reign. At some point, he's returned to Yerushalayim as a vassal of Bavel. He submits to Babylonian rule for 3 years, but then rebels against Babel, at which time Nebuchadnezzar enters Yerushalayim and carts Jehoiakim off to Babel. Although the verse in the previous chapter related that Jehoiakim was evil, the text does not give us details about his depravity. The Gemara in Sanhedrin 103a and b traces the progressively worsening behavior of the evil Judean kings, from Ahaz to Menasha to Amon. However, it seems that Jehoiakim took things a step further, stating that his predecessors did not know how to properly anger God. It's important to note here that it's difficult for us to relate to people who lived in a time where self-awareness was centered in a person's transcendent source. When we discuss kings who did things against God, lahachis, deliberately to anger God, this itself indicates that they had a clear awareness of God's existence. Since the Jewish people at this time had a different level of awareness of God as the source of reality, the standards to which they were held were different than ours. We can compare ourselves today to a person who plays around with electrical circuits, but doesn't know much about electricity. He might get hurt, but we can't really blame him since he doesn't know better. However, the kings who reigned during the era of prophecy were like someone who plays around with electrical circuits in a dangerous fashion, but knows good and well how they work. When this person causes an explosion and people are severely injured, especially if he does this deliberately, he would be held to a much higher level of accountability. The topic of how to relate to the sins of people during the era of prophecy is a larger topic, deserving of much greater attention than we have time for here. In Jehoiakim's case, the Gemara explains that he tries to divorce himself from any dependence on God. He declares that while God created earth to be mostly self-sufficient, we have been dependent on the external source of light that comes from the sun, which is outside of the earth. Jehoiakim proclaims that now he doesn't even need the sun anymore, since he has gold that shines as brightly as the sun, producing artificial light, which enables him to be completely self-sufficient. The Gemara, as well as the Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah, lists other outrageous behaviors that Jehoiakim did, like tattooing God's name on a covered area of his body as a sign of contempt, as well as personally engaging in deliberate incest, both aimed only at angering God. When Yirmiyahu HaNavi attempts to chastise Jehoiakim, sending him a scroll with ominous prophecies, Jehoiakim cuts up the scroll and throws it into a fire. As far as fulfilling his role as a Jewish king, Jehoiakim's hubris, his gaiva, is striking, and it's obvious that he did not lead the people to the will of God. In fact, the Gemara in Sanhedrin 103a states that God wanted to destroy the entire world due to the evil of Jehoiakim. However, it's a testament, perhaps, to the positive impact of Yoshiyahu's Tshuva revolution that there were many righteous people, prophets and Torah scholars, active in his generation despite Jehoiakim's evil behavior. The Talmud states that it is in their merit that God does not destroy the world during Jehoiakim's time. The Schar Va'onash, the divine accountability for human behavior, plays out in Jehoiakim's death after he is deported by Nebuchadnezzar. He dies on the way to Babel, and his body is disgraced, fulfilling the prophecy of Yirmiyahu in Yirmiyahu 36:30 that he will be buried like a donkey. However, the deep rupture in the relationship between God and the Jewish people that had originated with Menashe's efforts to anger God is what places the brunt of the blame for the Chorban, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, at the feet of Menashe, as stated in verses 3 and 4 in our chapter. Sometime later, we see the Schar Va'onesh, the divine accountability, with Paro Necho as well, who is pushed out of regional politics, neutralized by Nebuchadnezzar. The Ralbag explains that this was a punishment for Paro Necho's killing of the righteous king Yoshiyahu. Jehoiakim is succeeded by his son Yechoniah, who is renamed Jehoiachin by Nebuchadnezzar. We are told in Pasuk Tet, verse 9, that he is evil like his father. He rules for only 3 months, after which Nebuchadnezzar advances on Yerushalayim, and despite an appeal of loyalty on Jehoiachin's part, he is exiled and imprisoned in Babel for the next 37 years. After exiling the king, the Babylonians loot the Beit HaMikdash and the royal palace, fulfilling the nevuah, the prophecy that was given to Chizkiyahu by Yeshaya, that we heard in chapter 20, verse 17, and is also found in Yeshaya 39:6, which states, Hine yamim ba'im, behold, the time is coming. V'nisa kal asher b'bitecha v'asher atzrua b'techa ad hayom hazeh bavela, when everything in your palace, which your ancestors have stored up to this day, will be carried off to Babylon. Lo yivater davar amar Hashem, nothing will remain behind, said Hashem. When King Jehoiachin is exiled, the elites of Jewish society are exiled to Babel along with him. This large group of people, numbering 10,000 individuals, is described in Psukim Yodalid and Tetvav, verses 14 and 15. It includes the royal family, the nobility, and a group called the Charash v'Hamazger, which Targum Yonatan translates as the artisans and gatekeepers, meaning the middle class. The Gemara interprets the phrase Charash v'Hamazger metaphorically, as referring to Torah scholars. These Torah scholars included the Navi Yechezkel, Mordechai of the Purim story, and Daniel. If you recall the verse from Megillat Esther that is read to the tune of Eicha, as follows, Asher haglam Yerushalayim, im hagola asher haglata, im Yechoniah melech Yehuda, asher hagla Nebuchadnezzar melech Babel. He had been exiled from Yerushalayim, in the group that was carried into exile along with King Yechoniah, who is, as we have said, Jehoiachin of Yehuda, which had been driven into exile by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babel. And that's how Mordechai goes into exile with Yechoniah, with Jehoiachin. On the one hand, the exile of the religious and social leadership is a blow to the Jews remaining in the land of Israel. The group that remains in the land of Israel is primarily composed of the Dalat Am Haaretz, the poorest element of society. On the other hand, however, this phenomenon does have a silver lining. The people who are exiled to Babel are able to lay the foundations for a flourishing Torah community. after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, which we'll discuss in the next chapter, where the entire nation was exiled to Babel, they found teachers, Torah academies, and communal institutions already established and waiting for them, which aids in their spiritual survival as a nation. In fact, the Jewish community in Babel enjoyed long periods of peace and prosperity, and were able to later use those opportunities to organize and record the Babylonian Talmud, preserving the oral law for the millennia of exile to come. After exiling the bulk of the Jewish population, Nebuchadnezzar appoints Jehoiachin's uncle, Matanya, the third son of Yoshiyahu, to the throne, renaming him Tzidkiyahu. In evaluating Tzidkiyahu, there is a seeming inconsistency between the way he is described in Malachim and the way Chazal evaluates Tzidkiyahu. Pasuk Yutet, verse 19 states, Vaya'as hara be'inei Hashem, he did what was evil in the eyes of Hashem. However, the Gemara describes him as a tzaddik, a righteous person. How do we understand this discrepancy? As we explained earlier, Menashe's sins had deeply scarred the nation. Even the great Yoshiyahu was not able to repair this rift between God and the Jewish people. However, this did not need to lead to complete destruction. Yirmiyahu tells Tzidkiyahu in chapter 38 of Yirmiyahu that he could save his own life, the city of Yerushalayim, and the lives of his family if he submits to Bavel and remains, as described in Yechezkel 17:14, a mamlacha shefala, a lowly kingdom. If he would humbly accept his new status as the leader of a subservient vassal state to the powerful Babylonian Empire, then the Jewish nation could remain in the land of Israel. In fact, they could have made the most of that experience, since deprived of the distracting pull of power and prestige, they could have focused inwardly on the spiritual rejuvenation that was so desperately needed at the time. Unfortunately, however, there were false prophets preaching to the people at the time, feeding them hopeful, but false, prophecies about a weakening Babylonian Empire and the imminent return of the exiles from Babel. The Jews remaining in the land of Israel, after the exile of Jehoiakim, were the Dalat Ha'am, the poorest and spiritually weakest elements, and they eagerly bought into these enticing messages that everything would be okay. Tzidkiyahu's ministers were aligned with the popular sentiment and were militantly against submission to Babel. Although Tzidkiyahu was a righteous individual on a personal level, he was cowed by his ministers, and he failed to act courageously as a leader and do what he knew would be best for the people. Divrei HaYamim Bet, Chapter 36 explains that there were two ways in which Tzidkiyahu sinned. Firstly, verse 12 in Divrei HaYamim states, Lo nechna mipnei Yirmiyahu hanavi. He didn't humble himself before Yirmiyahu. Although he's respectful of Yirmiyahu, he doesn't listen to his advice to submit to Nebuchadnezzar. In addition, Tzidkiyahu had sworn his loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar in God's name, but later broke his vow in rebelling against Nebuchadnezzar. At this late stage, Hashem wanted the Jewish people to lose their independence, which they no longer deserved. Yirmiyahu understood that they were undeserving, which is why he repeatedly encouraged the last few Judean kings to submit themselves to the Babylonians. Therefore, in this context, rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar is considered a rebellion against Hashem. Although the sages emphasize that personally Tzidkiyahu was a righteous individual, he is evaluated in the Book of Kings as a failure in the context of his role as a king. We will continue to follow the story of Tzidkiyahu in the next and last chapter of Sefer Malachim. In this chapter, we see that even when the Jewish people is standing at the brink of disaster and destruction, God's love and kindness for the Jewish people shines through. The exile of the elites and the Torah scholars at an earlier stage, which no doubt at the time was unbelievably demoralizing, allowed for the development of the social and religious infrastructure that would allow the Jewish people to survive in exile. Thank you for studying together. Le'iloi Nishmas Frida, Bat Moshe Eliyahu.